supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Over the years, I've seen dozens of patients who've had symptoms and illnesses that never get a clear diagnosis or treatment. They may have chronic pain, numbness, unexpected muscle weakness, or vertigo. These patients come to me out of fear, sometimes hopelessness, sometimes desperation. They want to know when to pursue this further, and they want to know, is it time to give up and just live with this? It's so common that the most recent edition of the American Psychological Association Monitor on Psychology featured an article about the topic called When Symptoms Are a Mystery. So we're going to talk about mysterious symptoms and living with undiagnosed symptoms with our guests today, Ellen Dornelis and Daniel Monti. Ellen Dornelis is a health psychologist in Hartford, Connecticut, who was quoted extensively in the Monitor article. She joins us by phone. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And Daniel Monti is executive and medical director of the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine here in Philadelphia, and we have him by phone as well. Welcome back, Daniel.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'd love to hear from you if you or a loved one or maybe your physician. We're talking about symptoms that don't have a diagnosis. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. Ellen, I want to pick up with you what I said in the introduction about that APA Monitor article. As recently as 15 years ago, we would label that these cluster of symptoms psychosomatic, and a doctor would say, in so many words, it's all in your head, go see a therapist. To a certain extent, that still goes on today. So what's changed over the years?
Yeah, I think that's very difficult when you're a patient because there's such a stigma still associated with that idea that something could be all in your head. And medicine has been a little slow, I think, in coming to the idea that it's never all in your head or all in your body, that, you know, it's somewhere in the middle. So I think that there's a growing understanding of the relationship between the mind and the body over the last 20 years.
Is that a safe generalization?
It probably depends where you seek your medical care. I think that there are some very psychologically savvy clinicians and practitioners in healthcare, and some that really have somewhat older models and ways of thinking about it that really divide symptoms into either mental health symptoms or physical symptoms.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. And speaking of that, Daniel, when I treat a patient with an undiagnosed illness, they inevitably want to know how much of this is in my head and how much is real. It's almost as though, you know, if they knew the formula, they would know how to fix it. And in a way, that makes sense, you know?
Right. And I would have to underscore that, you know, nothing is ever 100% in our head, so to speak, or our bodies, and that you know, the mind and the body are flip sides of the same coin. And you know, in integrative medicine and health psychology and what you do, we really are guided by a biopsychosocial model where all three of those components affect the way that we feel. And the literature is clear that stress and emotional distress can make any physical problem worse, and virtually every disease we know of, the outcomes are worse if our stress levels are high or we're feeling distressed. And it's impossible to know what exact percentage is contributing to that, but one of the things that I think is helpful when we talk to patients at the Myrna Brin Center or whether it's a primary care physician talking to a patient, is that we have the conversation in terms of a stress model and the contributions of stress, whether they be physical stressors, psychological stressors, social stressors, that can impact the outcome of any illness or just the way we feel in general.
I want to talk about this stuff that you talk about, stress. And we know that, you know, all this cortisol flowing through our bodies can even be lethal, but with high level of stress, can it be all in your head? Can stress itself create physical symptoms?
Absolutely. If we think about, but again, stress is never all in your head. If we think about the autonomic nervous system, one way of defining stress is being kind of in fight or flight mode too much. And so if the two branches of that system are fight or flight, which is the sympathetic nervous system, or restoration and recuperation, which is the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system, if we're in fight or flight too much of the time because of stressors, then that's going to affect the body. You know, this originally was good for us. If we saw a lion in the jungle in the distance, we would want to be mobilized, go into fight or flight, and climb up a tree or get a weapon or do what we needed to do to survive that stressor. The lion passes, things go back to baseline homeostasis. However, now that the lion in the jungle is replaced by your boss who's, you know, being overly demanding, the deadline for the week, your children who might be ill, your parents who are having health issues, and they're ongoing for many people, so that they never get out of that fight or flight mode. And when we're in fight or flight, think about what the body does. It prepares you to mobilize. Digestion shuts down. You become hypervigilant and aware. Number one problems people have are with sleep, with digestion, with GI complaints, those kinds of things. There's a large contribution of stress to a lot of those problems for many people. And stress is a culprit. And you mentioned cortisol, Dan. That's just one of many chemicals. In fact, cortisol is often the agent provocateur of everything bad, but going along with high cortisol levels are high levels of inflammatory chemicals. Hmm. And those inflammatory chemicals that are secreted by being in a chronically stressed mode and other lifestyle variables can cause all kinds of symptoms and all kinds of issues for people.
So, and of course this feeds on itself, because once we are in that cycle of stress, then, you know, when somebody cuts you off on the road, it can feel like a mountain lion. Or, you know, if
exactly.
a child doesn't get their homework done on time, it can feel like a mountain lion. So it does feed on itself. But I'm going to, Ellen, is ultimately the path to finding peace here, is it just finding a way to live with the unknown? I mean, when is it time to stop pursuing symptoms and finding a way to live with what is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that the issue of undiagnosed illness is that often docs do acknowledge that there may be something physically going on that they just don't understand yet. And patients, I think they're very often very sophisticated, at least the ones that I come across, in terms of saying, yep, I understand that stress has a role in, you know, making things worse, but what do I do about it? How can I either live with these symptoms and cope with them in a better way? So I think that sometimes what psychology can bring is that, and all mental health really, just the notion that you have a chance to sort out some of what your symptoms are and get some perspective on it, understand a little bit better the degree to which stress is making it worse and what can be done about that. Getting some support and ways to cope with it can be very helpful.
If you're just tuning in, that was Ellen Dornelis. She's a health psychologist. We're also joined by Daniel Monti, who's executive director of the Jefferson Myrna Brind Center at, like I said, at Jefferson. And we're talking about symptoms that don't ever get diagnosed, symptoms that we're living with that become chronic in the relationship between, I guess, mind and body. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Daniel, I read where the most common complaint physicians hear is that of fatigue. And I've complained to my doctor about that myself. But, I mean, there's only so far Western medicine can go with it.
That's right. Fatigue is a very common complaint, and fatigue is a symptom. Right. And so even if we, you know, diagnose fatigue, and there's, you know, ICD diagnoses related to fatigue, it doesn't necessarily say much about the etiology of the fatigue. Sometimes that etiology is clear. We diagnose an acute infectious process or some other acute problem. But in the absence of an acute problem, after a comprehensive workup, to make sure that there's nothing, no emergency issue going on, no acute problem that we can define going on, you're left with a whole host of chronic contributors to the fatigue. And sometimes you can identify and get to the root of the fatigue, and sometimes not. Sometimes it is stress, like we were talking about. But as we get older, sometimes it's a hormonal problem that really requires a comprehensive investigation that can be missed or not assessed in a primary care model. Sometimes there are nutritional deficiencies. Sometimes the person is having sleep problems, and they actually have sleep apnea and don't know about it. This sort of whole person approach to assessing and diagnosing the etiology of the fatigue is important. Many people don't have access to that kind of an approach, and many primary care physicians simply don't have the time. They're putting out fires all day with very brief visits and can't do that. And then there's a whole group of people who actually do get a very comprehensive workup, and it's still unclear what's causing
right,
the fatigue.
Right. And Ellen, we know that one of the cardinal symptoms of depression is fatigue.
Yes, absolutely. And co-occurring depression with virtually any medical illness is the bread and butter of my business, as I'm sure it is for yours as well. So what to do about that? I often think of it, at the risk of sounding a little trite, with a two-handed approach. You know, on the one hand, you're trying to get the best quality of life if the symptom doesn't change. And on the other hand, you're trying to keep searching to see, you know, what works medically or, you know, in terms of helping that symptom and getting some relief from it. So it's, I think it's a challenge for people coping with things that don't have an easy diagnosis. And we still have this perception in medicine that our physicians can give us all of the answers. And it's a process. It's a real process and journey to get to those answers.
Well,
and
sometimes
there is no answer.
I want to suggest something else. Sometimes physicians can't get to answers. We look to physicians for the answer, but often physicians are unable, unwilling to look at a patient and say, I don't have these tools for you. I don't have the resources here to help you. Maybe there's someone else who can do it. That's a hard thing for a physician to say. Let me pass that to you, Daniel, as a physician.
I think that there is some of that. On the other hand, I think that there's many primary care physicians out there that are happy to refer when there's a complicated problem to other people who might be able to address it. But the larger issue that you might be talking about, Dan, is that we have to acknowledge that modern medicine is really good at a category of problems,
right,
acute issues, infectious disease, surgical issues. If somebody has an acute trauma, you know, I would want them to be brought into the emergency room, have one of our Rothman doctors take care of the bone fracture and so on, and we're very good at those types of problems. Where we fall short are chronic issues and chronic complaints. That's where there is often dissatisfaction from the patient, from the consumer, people who have these nagging chronic complaints, because our medicine and our modern medical approach is best when there's a circumscribed acute issue. And we need to think more holistically, more within the biopsychosocial model when we have these chronic problems, because often it is depression or stress that's contributing, or something else in lifestyle, diet, nutrition, sleep, those types of things that require a more expansive view.
And they require time.
Time, which many doctors don't have.
Before we go to our break and take some callers, I want to push this a little bit further, Ellen, and I want to talk about chronic fatigue syndrome. And we know sometimes antidepressants help, but it's not necessarily depression. I've got a dear friend and colleague who has this, and his breathing is labored just as he walks down the hall in my house, and he doesn't seem depressed.
Right, and that can be very frustrating to have it captured in that way when it doesn't feel like depression and may not be depression. I'm no expert on chronic fatigue, although I've encountered it in my practice. My practice has been primarily a cardiac practice and then a cancer practice. One of the things that I often find that's a real challenge is that when you're trying to get a definitive medical diagnosis, physicians have to practice sort of in a preventive sort of a way, and you often get a lot of tests and workup and often try out different medications, and those in turn then give you symptoms and reactions, and it can be very hard to tease out what are your root symptoms, what are reactions to the treatments or tests you've already had. You know, how much of it is frustration at and psychological distress at not feeling well. It's a real challenge.
Dan, what's your take on chronic fatigue? What are you doing at the Myrna Brin Center?
Yeah, chronic fatigue is a complicated issue. In the absence of an acute diagnosis, you try different things. Sometimes an antidepressant helps, not because the person is depressed, but because there's a presumed shared biology in the fatigue, but it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes a careful dietary and lifestyle modification can make an important impact on the person. And we found that there's a subgroup of people that carefully looking at their hormonal system and providing some hormone modulators can help. And then, of course, there's some people that you do everything and, you know, address everything you can in that biopsychosocial model, and they don't get a lot of response. But I think that we have a little more success than a conventional model with something like chronic fatigue because of what you said earlier, which is the time to really comprehensively evaluate the problem.
Right. We've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the major issue of pain. We've got callers coming in, and many of them want to talk about pain. We're talking about symptoms without a diagnosis, illnesses without a diagnosis that go from acute to chronic, and how we live with them and what our options are. My guests are Ellen Dornelis, and she's a health psychologist at Hartford, Connecticut. I'm also joined by Daniel Monti, who's the executive and medical director at the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center for Integrative Medicine. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have symptoms that you are struggling to find a way to live with, give us a call, someone in your family, or perhaps you're a physician and want to chime in. Again, that's 888-477-9499. 9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Liev Schreiber. He stars as a Hollywood fixer and tough guy in the new Showtime series, Ray Donovan. He's played more than his share of bad guys, he thinks, because of his face.
Arched eyebrows and Slavic fat pads, unfortunately, I think make me look a lot more menacing than I really am.
You mean like slightly puffy cheeks?
Yes, puffy cheeks.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about undiagnosed illnesses, symptoms that we struggle to live with. We chase after doctor and still don't get any answers. My guests are Ellen Dornelis and Daniel Monti, and our number is 888-477-9499. I want to talk with both of you about the issue of pain and pain management. It's a major issue here. We'll start with you, Dan. Tell us about first the psychobiology of pain. Where does it light up in the brain, and what are some causes for invisible pain?
Right, so pain is complex, and there's different areas of the brain responsible for the pain response. The suffering that goes along with chronic pain is a significant issue, because two people with similar types of injuries and a pain response can suffer with that pain differently based upon a whole host of factors, from personality to their baseline level of distress, like you mentioned earlier. Then you add pain to that, and the distress from the pain and the suffering that they encounter is different and higher and more problematic.
I'm glad you said that, because there's a whole lot of judgment there about people with low pain threshold or considered weaker.
Right. It's not so much that they're weaker. They usually have a heavier burden of distress to begin with. And you know, there are people, there are very varying degrees of pain thresholds, but it has nothing to do with weak or strong. Sometimes a very reactive nervous system that might make you more aware of pain serves you in other ways, whereas it contributes to a more acute sense of pain when you're experiencing it. So we're all unique and different in that way, but it's not about weak and strong.
You know, the article just came out about women and overdosing from, you know, pain drugs like OxyContin and so on and so forth. And, you know, the numbers there are astounding. I think the number of women dying from prescription painkillers has quadrupled over the last decade, not to mention addiction and so on and so forth. And I'll turn to you, Ellen. Are we having increased pain? Are we more vulnerable to substance abuse? What's going on here?
Well, certainly I think that there is an increasing use of medication to treat pain, and then it becomes difficult to determine what will be helpful for the pain. I think one of the difficulties with pain is that when you're in pain, you feel a lot of anxiety, and that then increases your perception that the pain is worse. So, for example, something like childbirth, when we teach women prepared childbirth, we don't teach it all in the day that they're having pain. It's sort of a gradual preparation. And I think that teaching people cognitive behavioral responses that help them cope with pain, to find a focal point, learn diaphragmatic breathing, very basic things, can be very helpful. But it's not something that you can learn quickly or in one shot. There's a lot of practice that goes with that to learn to manage your pain better.
Well,
if you don't practice. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the things I've learned, you know, I've got chronic severe pain myself, and there's a point where I stopped looking for ways to make it better and mm-hmm. finding ways to live with it. And there was a brief period of depression with a small d and hopelessness, but, you know, once I got past that, it's like I'm more comfortable with it in a strange way. I mean, you know, I'm not thrilled about having pain, but the storyline just drops away, that this is what it means and this is what I need to do and this is awful and all of that. You know, it's pain.
Right. And probably some days are worse than others. And I think for people learning, you know, how to stay in that zone, what makes it worse, what makes it better, some degree of acceptance for pain that won't respond. You know, there are folks that can really hold out hope that modern medicine or other kinds of behavioral techniques will improve their pain. That's a very helpful thing. And for some folks, when they've gotten to the end of the road and they feel like, well, geez, I've really exhausted all my treatment possibilities, I've tried everything, trying to shift the brain to understand, you know, what distracts you from the pain, what helps you cope with it in a better way, what makes your mind shift so that you're able to live with it, is a very useful life skill.
Yeah, it's like give up the fight, stop fighting with it and against it. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people want to join our conversation. We'll start with Alana from Philadelphia. Hi, Alana.
Hi.
Hi.
So, thank you. What you're saying is very related to what I was calling in about. I have chronic pelvic pain and chronic arm pain and urinary symptoms. And it all started about 10 years ago. I used to be a harpist as my job, and something about the awkward positioning, that's the working theory, spending so many hours in an awkward position, it never went away. I had pain every day. And for me, what made it manageable was when I gave up trying to wish for a time without pain. I don't think that will be in my future. And the new goal for me became to have a functional life. So, which I do. I have a job that I love and a house. And to me, that was, once I was able to shift my goals, I was able to find happiness again.
Mm. And happiness. Happiness with pain.
You know, mm-hmm. I would comment that both our caller and you, Dr. Gottlieb, describe a coping mechanism that almost defines mindfulness. And mindfulness or mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a standardized 8-week program that we offer at the Myrna Brin Center, but so do places all around the country, has been shown to be very helpful with people who have chronic health complaints, including chronic pain, because it actually teaches that coping mechanism that you both arrived at.
Right, and it teaches it in a very methodical, focused way. And ultimately, you know, mindfulness, ultimately being awake to our lives, is really, well, living in the moment, being open to the lives we have without fighting and without wanting to change it.
Exactly.
I would also say something else, Alana, that happened to you. And I'm sure I mentioned this story on the show before, but it was about Pandora's box. And you know, the box contained all of the evils of the world, and she was told not to open it, and she did. And all the evils got out except for one. And the evil that remained in there was hope. The evil of hope. And what you did, Alana, was you gave up hope that this pain was going to go away, that it should go away or would go away. You gave up hope and lived with what is. Because all hope's about the future. It's really a shift. It's really a shift. So I'm happy, and I appreciate your teaching here on the show today. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Paul on the line. Hi, Paul. Do we have you?
Hi. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. What can we do for you?
I'm calling from Delaware, and been having a lot of stress from work, and therefore I have body aches from my neck all of the way down to my feet. And the only thing that really works is Motrin. Went to the hospital, they did blood work, and nothing was there. So it is a mystery.
Well, I'm not so sure it's a great mystery. I'd like to hear both my guests weigh in on this. Ellen, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's a really common thing, because when you do feel a lot of stress, you tend to tense your muscles, and some people just do it in one part of the body, like the jaw, to the point that you could break a tooth, and some people do it all over. And sometimes it's hard to tease out, you know, muscular tension and to know, okay, it's great that it gets relieved with Motrin. A lot of folks then would sort of say, well, you know, what can you do to relieve the underlying stress? And I'm sure it's not a simple answer at all. But things that relax the body can be very helpful, like massage. It sort of teaches your body to do what it's not able to do physically on its own. And diaphragmatic breathing, practicing relaxation techniques. I'm a big believer in trying a lot of different things and then seeing, you know, what takes for you, because any one thing might not work, but trying a number of different techniques, you may in fact find that things like stretching, yoga, that sort of thing, even though it might not be something you'd normally try, you might try it and see whether it's helpful for you.
I will.
Dan, did you want to add to that? Daniel Monte?
I think that the big ones were covered there. I would underscore again mindfulness as a stress reduction program. And also, when we're talking about manual therapy such as massage, to consider other things like focus trigger point work, things that can target where there is tension in the body, but learning to cope with the stressors through either individual work or a structured program like MBSR is really a good first step to consider.
Well, I want to add something else. Paul, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Thank you.
All right. I've got a radical idea. Don't go away yet. What do you love?
My family.
Okay. What do you love to do?
That's probably the problem. I don't have any great hobbies. I'm not big hobbies that I do. I pretty much go to work, kind of it.
Well, let me ask you something different. What brings you joy?
Talking to family, talking to my mom, talking to my siblings.
Or do you feel joy when you're doing that?
While I'm talking to them, do I feel joy? Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yes.
And here's what I want you to do. In addition to everything Ellen and Daniel said, I want you to do whatever you need to do to experience joy every day. It's critical. It's as important as food. Experience joy every day. Don't just do things you think you like, but experience joy. Okay?
Oh, I like that.
Really important. Yeah, and then increase that every day, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, increase the dose as tolerated.
Okay.
All right.
All
right.
Take
care of you.
All right. You too. Thank you.
Yeah, and what we heard from Paul is, I'm sure, very, very common. It's tension and body aches. And what we do when we feel that is, you know, we go to, like you said, Dan, you know, we go to Western medicine and all they have is really pills and knives.
Right.
We're going to take a break. We've got a lot of callers now who want to join the phone conversation. Well, and we do have a few lines open, so please feel free to call us about undiagnosed symptoms. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Daniel Monti and Ellen Dornelis. Monti is Executive Director at the Myrna Brin Center for Integrative Medicine at Jefferson. Ellen is a health psychologist in Hartford, Connecticut. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, what's the future of the Muslim Brotherhood now that President Morsi has been ousted in Egypt?
We will not stop working for this country. We are not in a corner. We are not isolating ourselves. We are here.
We'll have the latest from Cairo next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about undiagnosed illness, symptoms that we just can't find an answer to. My guests are health psychologist Ellen Dornelis and integrative medicine physician Daniel Monti. Let's go right back to the phones. We've got Dan on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What can we do for you?
I just wanted to kind of share my personal experience. I'm 25 years old now. About 5 years ago when I was around 20 years old, I started experiencing a lot of chronic abdominal pain. And it went on for a little while. You know, I'd experience it a few times a day. So I finally went to the doctor. And, you know, long story short, I got passed around from a few doctors, some specialists, and, you know, did the CAT scans and the renal scans and all that. And, you know, one doctor said possibly cancer. So, you know, that's not something you want to hear when, you know, you're that young. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, went through a few more tests. And eventually it came back. There was really nothing tangible that they could diagnose, but I was still experiencing this pain. So, you know, after they cleared me from anything that was life-threatening, I kind of did my own research and came back to the doctors and said, well, you know, I found something called chronic pelvic pain syndrome, and could that be it? And, you know, what it essentially was, according to what I dug up, was that it's chronic prostatitis that is brought on by stress triggers, possibly. And so I brought it to the doctors, and they said, well, you know, are you under a lot of stress, anxiety? And I said, yeah, you know, I have a lot of that in my life. And, you know, they said, well, that can certainly be it. But it kind of dropped right there. There wasn't really any way of pursuing it beyond that. So at this point, I've kind of just resorted to just coping with it. I still experience it, but, you know, going through more tests and pursuing more treatment is kind of more stressful than just dealing with the pain itself. So that's kind of just what I wanted to throw out to you guys.
Wait a minute. So what are you doing to take better care of your life?
What do I do to take better care of my life?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, honestly, there's really nothing that I've done to pursue further treatment. It's just kind of...
No. I'm not talking about your symptoms. I'm talking about your life. You said you're under a lot of stress.
Right. Honestly, you know, nothing really. You know, still stress from work, that sort of thing. I mean, I've taken up playing soccer as kind of a hobby to focus on, but nothing is really... flush the stress out of my life, so to speak.
Yeah, your language is interesting. Flush the stress.
Exactly. No pun intended.
Yeah, right. So I want to hear from my experts. Start with you, Ellen.
Well, I guess It sounds a lot like you're saying yourself that your body's telling you something. And you went pretty far with it in terms of ruling out a medical answer, which was the smart thing to do because I'm not a physician and neither are you, so you have to work that up and find out. But I would agree with Dan that you don't want to stop there. Stress is generally always treatable, and it's not, if there was an easy answer, you would have come up with it by now. So seeking out some outside forms of support, whether, you know, it's a therapist or a support group or an integrative medicine program like Dr. Monty runs in your area, there's just so many different options, and you kind of owe yourself the same way that you worked it up medically to pursue some of those, and you may not hit it on the first mark, just like you didn't medically. You may call a therapist, it's not the right fit. So you've got to chase it around for a while, but odds are there's an answer to your stress.
There is an answer for the stress, and I want to piggyback on what Ellen said, Dan, before we turn over to Daniel. Your body is calling you. Your body is saying, there's something wrong here. There's something wrong with our lives together, you and your body. Please pay attention, because I'm still going to be calling you one way or the other. So, you know, what I would encourage you to do is in a different attitude from pursuing symptoms to caring for your body with respect and compassion. Daniel, why don't you weigh in on this?
Yeah, what you both said, I couldn't agree more with. And I think one of the problems, Dan, that you may have stopped is we've become very accustomed to in our culture of relying on the physician to tell us what to do next. And your doctor didn't have an answer, or the doctors that you saw what to do next. Like, oh, I guess it could be this, so, you know, go cope with it, go deal with it. And there wasn't that intervention for you to do next, and you stopped there. And it's a problem with our society in general, and I think that we need to start thinking more proactively to take care of ourselves better, and that is going to contribute to the wellness deficit that we have in this country. You know, we have the best medicine in the world by almost any standard, but our healthy life expectancy in terms of the other industrialized countries in the world is abysmal. We don't make the top 10 list for men or for women. And the WHO puts us at about 37. There's lots of contributors to that, but one of them is this lack of a proactive stance, because we've been conditioned to be passive recipients of health care versus proactive participants. And for you, there's a lot more that you can do. And of course, the things that have been mentioned, addressing the stress, taking care of the stressors, but also I would wonder if really thinking about your diet and the effects that has on this pain that you feel in your gut. A lot of times people are lactose intolerant and don't know it. They might have gluten sensitivities, but really thinking proactively about the diet, I'd recommend a book that I can vouch for the author. It's called The Great Life Makeover, where we talk about things like stress and diet and how to put that together for yourself, and to also think about what specific questions you're going to bring to your doctor, because as we mentioned earlier in the show, physicians have less and less time and often don't have a direct answer or a direct solution for these types of issues.
So I do hope that was helpful. As far as the Great Life Makeover book you referred to, that was a shameless plug here, Monty.
Oh, well, you know, I won't say it was a plug. I don't know if I'll agree with the shameless part, but, you know, it actually covers these issues, and, yeah. I'm past the promotional part of the book. It's a couple years old now.
speaking of books, Ellen, your most recent book is called The Stress-Proof Heart, and you know, there's a great deal written about the relationship between heart health and emotional health. But tell us how we stress-proof a heart.
Well, it's certainly not not an easy, quick answer, that's for sure. But I think that one of the things when I worked exclusively with cardiac patients that I would find is that people would come in with common arrhythmias, say atrial fibrillation, and really anxiety would exacerbate that and make it worse, and they'd need help to try to cope with it in a better way, or they'd have a heart attack and then inexplicably feel the same kind of chest pain, go to the emergency room and be told, gee, this time it's not a heart attack, it's probably anxiety or stress. And I think those kinds of things are real common. Heart disease is the leading killer of folks in the United States as well as other industrialized countries. And learning to cope and gain better health in the face of cardiac disease is a real challenge. So learning some of the life skills that we've really already talked about learning to shift your mind when you can't get rid of pain, to improve your ability to be more stress resilient, to tackle anxiety or depression if that's what's plaguing you, to seek out sources of support. All of those factor in, I think, when you're talking about trying to stress-proof the heart.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Robert on the line. Hey, Robert.
Hello. I really enjoy this conversation. My sister has been dealing with pain for probably 35, 40 years, and the thing is that she keeps getting different diagnoses. The pain migrates all over the place, and it started years ago when she fell, and she broke her coccyx and had surgery, and apparently that didn't go too well. But since then, she's had so many different diagnoses. The pain has been in her head, in her stomach, in her back, her neck. She's had diagnoses of fibromyalgia. The latest one, there was one where they said she had a sinus ball behind the eye, and if they didn't remove it, she was going to die. That was many years ago, and she never had the surgery because of her sensitivity to surgery and the way she supposedly forms scar tissue on any surgery.
So let me
problem is that we don't quite know how to handle it because it just the latest thing is this multiple chemical sensitivity, and the doctors are telling her if she doesn't move that she's going to die. We're all going to die, but
you've heard,
they're making it sound like that it's multiple chemical sensitivity.
Let's hear what Daniel Monti has to say. I would imagine, Daniel, you have seen people in this position like Robert's sister.
Yeah. One of my favorite mentors was a neurology professor, Dr. Schwartzman, who taught us that when there's a severe injury like your sister had and the nerves are damaged, that nerves do these crazy things, and they don't heal like the rest of the body. And there's often all kinds of difficulties and problems from the healing process of nerves and chronic problems that are very difficult to address and very difficult to treat. I'm not sure where the multiple sensitivity issue comes into this, who diagnosed that. It's rare that I've to be told that you'll die if you don't move, but I'd have to understand a little bit more about what went into a statement like that. But what I would recommend is really a premier multidisciplinary pain clinic that has different pain specialists, including a health psychologist, as the very good programs do, but also, physical and rehabilitation physician, neurologist, anesthesiologist, people who can evaluate your sister and then do a multidisciplinary approach, because it sounds like the problem is severe and that she feels very unclear about the path forward.
I would also like to see someone in that program, Robert, as long as we can dream, to be a family therapist in there too, because you're suffering with this, obviously. The whole family is. And one of the things the whole family needs is, you know, some education around this, a more in-depth story about, you know, what Daniel Monti just said, but hearing in more detail what pain is, what happens, what can be done, what can't be done. And to answer your question, Robert, more directly about what can family members do in the face of this. Pain is exhausting, and it's exhausting not just for your sister. It's obviously exhausting for you also. So I appreciate your call. I do hope this was helpful to you. Ellen, we've only got a few seconds left, and I want to end with you. We started with you. What do you see as the future of all this work, this mind-body connection? Where do you see us in 10 years?
I mean, hopefully we'll have a more holistic system. And I think that if you're a person in the community with undiagnosed symptoms, you should be looking for a healthcare system where you can have a holistic approach, where you really are able to get a comprehensive evaluation of all of your medical symptoms, but also have a component of the psychological part, the behavioral part, and integrative medicine programs that offer that kind of complex care, I think are really the wave of the future for us. I think that we can learn a lot from that.
In my tribe, they say from your mouth to God's ears. I do hope that's true. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. We've been with Ellen Dornelis and Daniel Monti. Thanks again.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about compulsive buying disorder. Please comment on today's show. We'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can download this and other shows there. And follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Anna DiStefano is our summer intern. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.